Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We basically only really have one rule on the show and on this network, and that is to have fun. If you're having fun, the listeners are having fun, allegedly. Also, needed to remind listeners that your support is the reason why this show exists. In no small form, it's literally that, okay? Advertisers, hit and miss every now and again. Very few products get sold. But what does happen is that people will subscribe for a few dollars a month to get the Vinnie Eastwood Show commercial-free archives. And also, some people are donating about $20 a month to keep the lights on and the heat burning and so on and so forth. Coming into winter now in New Zealand, this house has got really high ceilings. It's fracking cold. I need a new pair of slippers. All right, basically that's what I need badly. It's a pretty rough existence, yo. New Zealand construction methods have not improved since the early pioneering days that much. Okay, and in fact, it's almost as if. They've employed Scotsmen to construct all the houses in order to insulate the cold so as to remind them of home. It's just that terrible. But conveniently, I have a number of jackets that have been donated to me over the years that are relatively warm and fluffy. Now, speaking of which, if you want to donate to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, there is a bank account for automatic payments on the homepage, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. So get on in there, or if you are capable, just get go for the PayPal, you know, a one-off donation would be lovely, or a monthly subscription of some size, ranging from $1 to $100 a month, whichever you can afford. And nobody so far has been able to afford $100 a month. The show's not that good. All right. My very special guests, Steve Wilner and Ezra Zera, welcome back. I was wondering where you would like to take the conversation now.
Wow, there's so many different ways we could go. You know, right now we're promoting this Music Myth Cosmos series, which we're also, you know, asking for donations and so forth. And maybe we can just give some more context as to the specifics of what we're doing in that documentary series.
Go for it.
Just to kind of come from my own background, I have a website called Tone Color Alchemy, and what I do there, I have these 6-week courses that I teach the fundamentals of the major arcana of the tarot. To give some background as to what that means, so you have in the standard playing deck of cards, you have what are called the pips, the ace through 10, and then you have the royal cards, the jack, queen, king. And there's a little bit of a difference between these cards and the tarot cards in that in the tarot, all of the cards you would see in a 52-card deck, those are all called the minor arcana, and there's 4 additional cards. So there's 56 cards in that minor arcana, but there's a whole other segment, which is called the major arcana, and that's composed of 22 cards. These cards could kind of be... you know, you could compare them to the Joker in the sense that they don't have a number and they don't have a suit. They have their own archetypal value. However, there's these 22 different archetypes that are represented. So when I first discovered music theory and I went through this academic curriculum and got to the end of the music theory program, I realized that there was something missing from the way they were telling the story of music theory and where it came from and how it works and how it affects us as listeners. So I wanted to go even deeper, and that's where I found all of this archetypal mythology to be really relevant. So I discovered this 22-card major arcana system as a key to understanding music theory, and here's why. So for those of you who are watching the video, I actually brought a visual aid. This is called, this is actually a part of the Rose Cross Lamen. This is basically a flower that's represented with 22 petals with a cross at the center. Now, the way that this is described, by a number of different teachings in the Western Hermetic tradition, is that you have at the center the three petals at the innermost center are called the mother letters, and they're said to be the mothers of the rest of the alphabet. So these three petals give birth to the middle layer, which is composed of seven petals, and finally the outer layer, which is composed of 12 petals. So when you add up the first, second, and third layers of three petals, seven petals, and 12 petals, you arrive at 22 petals, and this is the 22-petaled rose lamen. Now, those 22 petals correspond to the 22 cards of the major arcana. However, the correspondences don't end there because they also correspond to musical notes. Now, the interesting thing is that in the Western musical system, we only have 12 notes in the subdivided octave. That means that if you were to play the musical note C, and then you were to play the higher octave of that note, there are 12 notes in between there, including C, before you reach that octave. So those 12 notes are represented actually by the outer layer, which are these 12 petals. If you then go one layer in, you see these seven petals correspond with what's called a diatonic scale. So in music theory, the closest and most accessible analogy would be in The Sound of Music, that famous movie with Julie Andrews. She says, do, a deer, a female deer, re, a drop of golden sun. The whole scale is do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Everybody knows that. And if you just take the first seven, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, those correspond roughly to these seven inner petals. It's not a direct correspondence in terms of the actual tones attributed to that, but archetypally it resonates with the idea of that there's, out of these 12 different fundamental notes, you have this seven-note diatonic scale that emerges out of it. At the very center of the flower, you have the three petals, which are Aleph, Mem, and Shin, which correspond in tarot to the Fool, Judgment, and the Hanged Man, and they correspond to the musical notes C, E, and G sharp. They form a perfect triangle or an augmented fifth of the root, the major third, and the augmented fifth in music theory, for those who know the language. And what they represent is the idea of a musical chord. One of the definitions of a musical chord is that it has to be composed of at least three notes. If it's just two notes, it's a harmony, but if it's three notes, it's a chord. So the subdivision of this flower into three, seven, and 12 parts is a perfect simulacrum of the musical subdivision of the 12 chromatic notes into the seven diatonic notes into the three-note chord. So when I realized that there was this archetypal foundation that was shared between the tarot, between these Western hermetic magical orders that were using this tarot system as a foundation for their magical ritual practice, which, by the way, this is a derivative of the Golden Dawn, the hermetic order of the Golden Dawn out of Europe, out of Britain in the late 1800s, 1888,
as well as the OTO,
which is basically Aleister Crowley's derivative of the Golden Dawn, and also the BOTA, which is a hermetic order started by Paul Foster Case, not affiliated with Aleister Crowley, but it is affiliated with the hermetic order of the Golden Dawn. So if this might sound like a lot of information, but essentially what we're saying is that there are these orders of initiates in magical orders throughout the world, especially in the Western tradition, who have looked to this actual diagram as a foundation for enacting ritual practice. Which, what is the intention of those practices? Well, there's all sorts of different theories as to what the applications may be. Some of it is that it's mind control, manipulation of the masses, etc. But there's another teaching which actually, if you were to follow the text and the actual teachings of the groups themselves, this is considered to be the teachings of a brotherhood of light. And these different 22 petals are considered to be the 22 paths on the Kabbalistic tree of life. And the whole tree of life is seen as this diagram of the soul, as well as of the body, and the circulation of light from the very roots of our body, from our feet, all the way up to the crown, to our head. So,
like the chakra systems and so forth.
It's totally affiliated with the chakra system, which, as you know, there's essentially eight chakras. The first seven are from the root all the way up to the brow, and then the eighth chakra is the crown, which is sort of the expression of that seven chakra system, circulating as an auric egg or a field of light emanating from the crown or the top point of our head back down through the feet and circulating like a torus. Yeah. So this is really about the liberation of our physical energies and our sexual energies through certain types of meditation and magical practice. And at a certain point, that's so empowering that one could then begin to have effects on the external world in such a way that if the will of the magician was unclean in some way, that they had this malevolent intent, the power that they've cultivated through these magical arts could then be projected out into the world as symbolism, which is then perceived by the sort of initiated masses as this Illuminati symbolism or this negative symbolism. And that's only one expression of the teachings of this order, because the other teachings, the prime teachings of this group is about light and about the cultivation of light and the cultivation of personal power.
Sure.
So how we use that power is really up to each of us individually.
Has anybody ever been arrested for cultivation?
I don't think so. Unless it was cultivating, plants or something.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was referring to.
Right.
In terms of musical scales, and I was just thinking about this, in terms of therapy, are there any psychiatrists, psychologists, et cetera, out there who are using tonal experimentations to see if they can relieve people of, say, mental traumas or things of that nature? Any evidence of that?
Ezra and I had both used these light and sound devices that sync up binaural audio with a visual device, a little visor that has different color LEDs in the visor. And it's not unlike experiences that I've had in a float tank where you're suspended in a very saline water, where you're buoyant in water, and you close your eyes and you have sort of rapid-fire visuals in your own eyes without having any music whatsoever. But these light and sound machine devices attempt to mimic certain brainwave frequencies, beta, theta, to basically get you in the mode of getting prepared for REM sleep, or to regress your psychology back to a point in your history when you were a child. And all these things can be used with tonal devices and sound coming together. In a sense, the mediums are one and the same. The visual element and the audio element merge and create this holophonic bridge across both hemispheres of your brain, to where if you're open to the experience and you're using it as a guide for meditation and a guide for inner knowing and inner searching, you could definitely use that to search within yourself and quiet your mind and find different brain states and know how to initiate them without those tools as well. They're sort of like training wheels.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I understand that music can be very healing. I just wonder to what extent, you know.
Right. Well, that's where I wanted to also chime in. There was this guy, and what was the name of the? It'll come back to me, I'm sure, at a certain point. But there was a guy who was using binaural beats. It was the guy who actually started the whole binaural beat phenomena. And I've met a couple people who actually had worked for him. The name is escaping me right now, but. The whole idea was that he was like a PhD, and he was trying to figure out how the brainwave states were associated with behavior and performance, and how somebody who had gone through traumatic experience could put on a very simple, technically non-musical sound frequency device with these binaural beats and affect their brainwaves in a way that then they could perform more efficiently. And there has been a lot of scientific evidence that's an effective method, to where, I mean, I actually personally know sound therapists who their entire technique is to basically do simple hypnotic inductions through neuro-linguistic programming, and basically empower individuals to believe in themselves while hearing something that's recalibrating their hemispheric patterns in a way that they come out of the therapeutic environment with a sense of self-empowerment, with a sense of that they can go into their life and perform and succeed.
You could really wormhole into the intellectual side of how audio and sonics affect consciousness and how we could use that in subliminal ways. You could probably make a mixtape for your girlfriend using a binaural audio dummy head that suggests the name Vinny over and over again when she closes her eyes. If you want to really get crazy with it, you can. But I guess what we're talking about on another side of things is that it has a lot to do with joy. When you see dolphins creating those silver rings that they can create sonically with their own sound bursts from their whatever, their third eye, their vocal cords, they create these little silver rings in the water, and they're just playing with them. They're just having fun. So, like, sure, we as human beings, we're going to sit there and intellectualize and try to understand and format all these systems to autograph what all of these things do to our mindset. But if we look at animals in nature, they're just having fun with it. They're using pure sound as a way to just experience joy. That's it. It's not complicated at all.
See, I also wonder what's the opposite side of that spectrum, because if sometimes music can make you experience joy, then certainly it can make you experience hate. Like whenever I play any of my songs to the missus, she definitely starts to experience hate, and it's an instant just she hates it and wants to shut it off. You know, I hate your music, Vinny. I hate your voice. It sucks. Turn it off.
Oh, no.
Wow. Well, you know, what comes up for me when I hear that is that there's no particular genre that's been scientifically proven to create either joy or hate. For example, if somebody has a lot of anger pent up inside, and so they're already experiencing a lot of hatred towards whoever in their environment, when they put on music that's inherently angry or hateful, that could actually create joy just because they feel that they're mirrored by something. And so that I'm not of the belief that, oh, in order to like heal through music, we have to listen to like, you know, chirping birds and binaural beats. Yeah. No, I'm just saying that music liberates energies. So whatever we're feeling internally, music can match that. And it can do it in a way where it doesn't cost it. There's no resources. I mean, there, yeah, electricity or something, but whatever, it's when you take that and you compare it to pharmaceutical drugs where there's all these negative side effects and there's a cost of production, a cost of purchasing and all of that, music really eliminates all of that. And especially moving into the internet where there's this freedom of media, freedom of expression, music really seems to me like a free energy device of consciousness, if not literally at the level that that Steve and I are both dreaming up where, wow, someday we could literally teleport to another part of the universe with sound. Like, is that possible? Well, maybe, you know, but in the meantime, well, what about the idea of teleporting to a previous part of our own existence? So I put on a piece of music from my childhood. All of a sudden I have the somatic knowledge of what it was like to be a 7-year-old kid experiencing that music.
And I mean, this is just an assumption, but I think human beings, because of the evolution that our brains have taken over the reptilian and the mammalian layers of the brain, music affects us different than it would affect things in direct solid nature, like plants and animals. Masamoto, the science of plants and water.
Masaru Emoto.
If you played more aggressive kind of, you know, metal or like kind of angry music towards plants, there was a study that suggested that it wouldn't grow to their fullest extent, or they would be affected at least in some way biologically from the actual negative aggressive sounds of the music.
I saw an article just the other week, a guy put out, he put some seeds down and some water over them so that they would germinate, and he puts one tray of seeds next to his smart meter that's putting out all these EMF frequencies and one on the other end of the house, and the one next to the smart meter didn't germinate at all.
Yeah. It's the same with microwaves.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be right back after the break.
Germinating seeds that you've used microwaved water to.
We're coming to break. And we'll be right back to talk about more microwaves.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you. Give me a dessert. I'll do a dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. I'll have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back.
You want to know what it's like?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, and my very special guest, Steve Wildner and Ezra Zera. Where does the name Ezra Zera come from?
Are you descended from
an old like Pharaoic line of viziers, like hence the Zera? No.
Yeah, so I think Zero would be the feminine, you know, version of Zero. But no, it's actually just a joke because my first name is embedded in my actual last name, which is Sanzerbel. Sanzerbel is a little bit difficult for people to remember, so I just kind of eliminated all the extra words and just swapped around the E and the Z, so Ezra Zera.
I think it's quite musical, though. Sanzerbel, I always like that.
Right, there's the bell, all the resonance of that. Yeah,
it sounds like the name of some form of demon, you know? like Beelzebub or Zanzibel, you know?
In fact, in order to get Ezra to get to the apartment, I had to do a little ritual and conjure him. Right. He doesn't just come through the front door. You actually have to do it.
Right, I'm just a figment of your imagination, Vinny. Yeah.
Like he materializes out of the hairy doormat or something like that. He can only be summoned at certain times of the month.
That's why it's so fun hanging out with him, because I know I have a window of time I have with him.
Yeah. Whenever you're getting chased down by the cops for smoking weed in an alley or something like that, Zanzibel just disappears behind them and like whispers in their ear and she...
You probably haven't heard Portland because we actually don't have police here and we don't have any laws, so Portland's one of the few cities that doesn't have any laws.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want.
That's a half-truth. Yeah, hey, you know, I wanted to share something with you, though, on the theme of ritual magic and all of that, if you're open. So one of the things that Steve and I were talking about during the break, and we were talking with Adam, was there is this really interesting relationship between music and music and sound's effect on our external environment combined with ritual practice. And I think one of the most interesting examples of that, if we go back a couple thousand years or several thousand years, is into the building of the Egyptian pyramids. So to this day, scientists are kind of baffled. They're like, how is it that the architects who built the pyramids of Giza were capable of lifting these, what, over a ton? Each stone weighs over a ton. It's just, we don't even have the machinery today to be able to actualize this monument, these three pyramids. So what's the story? And how did it happen? And when I first started investigating that, one of the things I came across was this archaeologist who had field research on the topic of acoustic levitation. Now, we actually have right now, if you were to go on YouTube and type in acoustic levitation, we have scientists who have developed a form of acoustic levitation for, of course, it's funny, pharmaceutical industries. What they're doing is that they send two beams of sound, one from above and one from below, towards a focalized point. And because of the frequency they beam simultaneously, they're able to actually cause small droplets of water to hover in midair. And then they can inject pharmaceutical medications into them in order to be able to study them. So the reason I bring that up is because there is right now, the phenomena of acoustic levitation is a reality. And my question, what I've always wondered is, if we didn't have so many electromagnetic frequencies sort of like plaguing our planet, if we as a planet and as a race, as the human race, might be more susceptible and receptive to both planetary frequencies but also to frequencies on this planet generated by instruments, including the human voice on this planet. And I've always wondered if part of the secret teachings of not just Freemasonry, but of all of the Egyptian mysteries out of which it's derived, if one of the secret teachings wasn't around the idea of acoustic levitation and the use of the voice to manipulate. And I actually am of the belief and opinion that it's possible that these giant one-ton stones used to build, both like the megalithic monuments of the pyramids of Giza, but also, let's say, Stonehenge or whatever, that they were actually manipulated through sound.
Yeah. There's a structure in South Florida near Miami, actually I think it's Homestead, in the southern part of Florida, called Coral Castle. And it was these gigantic, even larger megalithic structures than the Egyptian pyramids. This man, Edward Lediskin, I think I'm saying his name correctly, took these pieces of coral and using techniques that he said that were derived from the secrets and the mysteries of the builders of the pyramids and Freemasonry, a sacred mathematical and potentially musical system to arrange these pieces of coral rock, this little frail man who was like 5'3", weighed nothing, into his 60s, built this for the love of his life, who actually never got to see the actual structure. I actually went to Coral Castle in South Florida, and there would be no way for a man of his stature and size, there'd be no way for 50 men of that stature and size to move those pieces of coral rock into the configurations that he had them in. And he built them in a way that it made it almost like astronomical, because he had them in set up as an observatory where you would see certain, just like in Stonehenge, where you would see certain solstices and full moon rises at these precise mathematical intervals. And he used the secrets of music and mathematics to do that. The keys that Pythagoras and many other of higher initiates of Freemasonry have used for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Now, on top of that, Gopher and I were watching a travel show. This lady goes around the world and stuff, and she's traveling down the Nile this one time on a boat with a local fisherman, And she asks him, so how do you think the pyramids were built? And he says, well, we've had the story passed down throughout generations. Everybody knows the story that the way that they moved the stones wasn't on boats like this because it would just crush it. It would sink. It was actually they'd just tap the stone with a wand and it would levitate and we'd float those along and walk them to the pyramids. And the lady's like, what? You know, just freaking out kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah. Oh, well, I suppose your explanation of like tens of thousands of slaves and stuff like that being able to move masses that are thousands of times them. I mean, like, even if ants that can move 10 times their body weight were translated to humans and you had tens of thousands of slaves, you still wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah, and that's not even speaking to the mathematical and musical tonality perfection of the way they built the interior of the pyramid, the king's mm-hmm. chamber, and the resonance of the way that the structures and the tunnels that funnel through the major pyramid of Giza are set up the way that they are. They would have initiates sit in water, and as we all know, cymatics and acoustics vibrate through water and more than any other medium, and we're, what, 80% water? A human being, a vessel, is mostly water anyway. They would have these initiates sit in these bathtubs on any kinds of strange concoction of psychedelics, DMT or whatever, and they would lay in the king's chamber and try to project themselves to a sort of telephone communication with the gods or those that came from the stars. And then he thought that that was one of the primary purposes of the pyramids, was to connect human beings with those that came before, those that made us, Prometheus style.
Mm-hmm. And there's also been a number of pyramid experiments. I believe it was either David Wilcock or Ian R. Crane did a presentation that I went to, and they've built this plastic pyramid in Russia. And the amount of amazing things that they've been able to discover, like if you give a milliliter of water that's been sat in that pyramid to a hemophiliac baby, the baby gets cured of its hemophilia.
Wow!
If you have rats that have tumors and you put them in the pyramid, their tumors go away, and all these other really amazing phenomenon. And the reason why it's plastic is because if it's metal, it doesn't work at all. And then you start to realize that, oh my God, did you realize that there are pyramids all over the earth? There's pyramids in China, there's pyramids in Bosnia and Egypt and Africa and South America, and the entire planet is literally covered in these fracking pyramids.
Yeah. And how did we learn of these strange technologies as children? One of the topics that Ezra and I cover in Music Myth Cosmos is we're the 80s generation. We grew up on video games. And what's the number one most popular video game of all time? Super Mario Brothers. And it's about these Italian plumbers. First of all, it's a Japanese-based game, like this oriented and originated from Japan. It's about these two Italian plumbers that take these psychedelic compounds, mushrooms, to gain powers, to grow in size and everything else. And one of the main aesthetic values of the game is that there's teleportation and Stargate aesthetics throughout the whole game that pertain directly to the ancient Egyptian pyramids. There's pyramids in all portions and sections of the game. And there's resonances of star travel and Stargate opening through musical devices throughout that game and many other games of that nature.
Mm-hmm. And we have one of the things we point out in the video is that that game Zelda, you know, so you have Mario and Zelda, two of the biggest video game icons of our generation, and both of them not only have warp whistles or the Ocarina of Time, which are basically essentially the same idea, but they also literally use the same melody. I mean, to the note and the same musical notes. If you watch the video, you'll be able to see. But this is maybe irrelevant for somebody who's not already inundated in that culture and who didn't grow up with it and hasn't been imprinted by it. And yet it's still relevant as a cultural signifier that there is this deep undercurrent of awareness, understanding on the part of anybody who's seen these videos that music and magic are just a hairline fracture difference. The main difference is that magic, you can't really prove that it exists. It's all illusion. We're these like reductionist, materialist, scientific, you know, belief systems. That's what we've been given. And we're like totally bought into that. And if it doesn't fit into that we won't buy in. And so when we see magic, we know, oh, it's just a stage trick. But if we hear music, well, we know that it's just a musician playing the notes, but it still affects us emotionally, just like a stage trick would. And so the whole thing of like, yeah, is music literally able to open up dimensional portals? Well, I think that it could be so. And I think Steve is of the same opinion. But even if that were not the case, even if that's, there's just no way that's ever possible, it doesn't change the fact that our consciousness has been inundated with the symbology of music as a magical trigger, and that the fact that music is one of the primary culture generators of our world.
I'd even go as far as that metaphorically, music is what is ingrained in children to take their creative spirit into realms of the unknown, to take it to the furthest possible state. And maybe what a lot of yogis use in their meditation is formed when they're children, when they hear these musical Stargate symbols in their head, and they realize when they're a child for the first time that anything is literally possible, that they can create anything. I think music is a catalyst for that, and I think that's the key of all of these magical practices, is that it can open up the creative stargates within your own mind, and therefore, scientifically and in the real world, pragmatically, can open up all kinds of breakthroughs in medicine and science and travel and anything else you could possibly imagine.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, a lot of the really massive bands and cultural icons of the 60s, when this new age counter-revolution sort of started to happen, were all children of military intelligence people.
Yeah. The Doors and Jim Morrison and the story of his father as an admiral. It's really, a lot of that stuff's really intense. I agree.
Oh, yeah, and we did a good discussion with Jan Irvin and Joseph Atwell, I think it was last week or the week before, about the 60s counterculture and acid culture literally being created and fostered by the CIA in order to control the culture and force it down a particular path. And, you know, you see what happened, came out of there, like feminism and the breakdown of the nuclear family, the Rockefeller family. Foundation funded it, and now, hey, if you're a man or a woman, you can be taxed now, and you both have to work because the wages have been halved. So who's home to take care of the kids? Nobody.
What about
and you've got to spend your money paying somebody else who doesn't even have any familiarity with your kids to take care of them, because otherwise they wouldn't have anybody to look after them whatsoever, because you've got no family background and no grandparents to look after them, because everybody's gotten the frack apart from them because of divorce.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And look at the very powerful undercurrent that happened in the Laurel Canyon scene in the 60s as well. You had a very, very strong Luciferian current in music and bands that were associated with a very honest, you know, 1950s Pleasantville type mentality, like the Beach Boys. And like that was a real thing with the Manson murders and the Sharon Tate murder. And all those things had this sort of devilish Luciferian vibe to it. Yet the music itself on the surface was incredibly G-rated for kids.
Right. I just want to jump in there and clarify the history of that. So there was this guy, Dennis Wilson, who was the drummer of the Beach Boys. And he had just been driving and Charlie Manson was hitchhiking. And they got affiliated. And pretty soon Charlie came over. He actually broke into Dennis Wilson's house. But then brought like 7 or 8. Of his girls, and they were all naked. So when Dennis showed up at his house, there was Charlie Manson with 8 naked women, and they were all ready to have this orgy. And so they used sex and they used music in order to affect Dennis Wilson, who was then able to actually bring Charlie Manson's music into the Beach Boys. And that happened. There's a song called Cease to Exist, which was translated as a Beach Boys song called Never Learn to Love. But it's an example of how you have this Luciferian character, Charlie Manson, who was able to affect the music industry and who had this influence on Sharon Tate, who was associated with a famous filmmaker, Roman Polanski, and so forth.
The most powerful icon that I've seen in film in my life that tied music and sex magic together was Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. If you remember, they had that at large Sonic ballroom party at the end of towards the end of the movie, where they had these like reverse keys that were very subtly minor, and they had all these people wearing masks in this very occult OCO like magical fashion, and they would play these keys in a certain way and go around in a circle almost like a zodiac, where these masked naked women were standing around in a circle around the Grand Meister, like that was dressed in all red. He could be the Prime Minister, he could be the President. In some respects, metaphorically, he represents like Obama or, you know, the Queen and like, you know, the most powerful icon sitting at the middle. And they were using this magical ketone with masks as a way to disguise themselves in a magical sex ritual. So I think that, just speaking to Ezra's point, that those things are tied together in a very significant way in upper echelons of government and the elite as well.
Indeed. And we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, my very special guests, Steve Wilner and Ezra Zera. Or Beelzebub, as he's commonly known. We'll be right back. ladies and gentlemen, kicking it, rocking it, in it. On the Vinnie Eastwood Show with my very special guests, Steve Wilner and Ezra Zera, otherwise known as Beelzebub. And their website is tonecoloralchemy.com and indiegogo.com. I think, I'm not sure if it's /, but anyway, Music Myth Cosmos is the ones there. And they've got lots of videos and things of that nature at youtube.com/soundlessdawn. That's Soundless Dawn. It's in a dawn without any sound. You know what I'm saying? Pretty straightforward. And labyrinthofthepsychonaut.blogspot.com is their blog. That's Labyrinth of the Psychonaut, which I believe... No, I don't have any belief structure on that, actually. What is the Psychonaut exactly?
A psychonaut is somebody that explores the furthest reaches of experience to try to find out the original meaning of what it is to be alive and breathing.
Righto. Astronaut, the explorer of space. Chrononaut,
it's the explorer
of time. And the psychonaut is the explorer of the mind.
It's certainly been associated with people that use psychoactives to try to find the root of their being, of why it is that they are alive. But that's not the only definition. It's just one of them.
Yeah. Well, if you think about our society and who runs it, I think there is a lot of psychos that are active out there.
Right. So I guess we're not psychos, too. We're psychonaut.
You've been criticized.
The article is also the exploration of sea, the last frontier, you know? It's going.
Yeah. See, I want
to get out there. Would you say
a child for being a bit psycho naughty?
Again, psycho naughty. That's funny.
Sorry, guys, you're breaking up.
The name actually, it also came out of, there's a guy, Peter J. Carroll, who's a chaos magician. Okay.
Yeah, I know. I can hear you fine. You're just kind of like breaking up just a little bit, you know, like how somebody kind of, you know how when people are possessed by demons, they start to speak in tongues and something like that? When people are possessed by Skype, they start speaking in sort of like this Cybertronian Transformer type voice, you know, like, you know, I call it the Megatron effect.
Are you upset with talking with Cybertronic Transformers, because we also do, we transform every once in a while into those vehicles.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah, well, as long as it's got the flames down the side, you know, it's all G unit.
Yeah.
Oh well.
All right, well, Vinny, what else do you want to talk about for the rest of the hour?
Well, you know, my show is actually about what my guest wants to talk about. Whatever I want to talk about is basically irrelevant by comparison, because I've got 5 days a week to say whatever I want to say, whereas you guys only have right now in the next 8 minutes.
That's true.
Okay. Well, I don't know if there's something you want to speak to. I know that there's something live for me. One of the teachings that's come through, there's a guy named Jocelyn Godwin, who's a professor at Colgate University in England. And he's written a bunch of books on, he wrote a really famous one called Music.
Whoa. Did you say Colgate University as in the toothpaste university?
Yeah, I think it might be sponsored by them or something, or not. I don't know. But that's how it's spelled, Colgate. Yeah.
I can't anyway, guarantee the guy, you that the professors are big advocates of fluoride. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the guy who I'm talking about, he's not at all affiliated. He's actually basically a conspiracy literature author who he's written about like Nazi UFO projects. But his main focus is actually not at all conspiratorial in the realm of politics. He's more into music mysticism, and so he and I have had this. We've had some one-on-one dialogues, and I have a really strong affinity with him. He's one of the only authors who's written about this topic in depth, and because he speaks German and he speaks Latin, he speaks French, he speaks English, he's able to translate all these different ancient texts into English, which is really a benefit for me as somebody who's researching this stuff. And so anyway, there's, you know, he's come out with all these different books, but one of them in particular has been a real inspiration for this upcoming video documentary that we're promoting. And it's called like the Music and Cosmos, or Cosmic Music. That's what it was. And I found this book after we started Music Myth Cosmos. It was a really beautiful synchronicity. And one of the things he does is he translates these three German authors. their central works into English. And he talks about the different theoretical sources of music. And I just wanted to bring that up while we still have a few minutes, because I think it's a really beautiful in route into what we're really trying to get at with our message and with our signal. So here it is. The story is that our soul is basically light. It emanates from our sun. And the sun, as it like sends out these cosmic rays, it reaches our planet. This sun ray comes into the earth, and over a period of time, it matures into a human organism, a baby. And that baby, the soul, is actually an expression of the fire of the sun, which in turn is just an expression of this cosmic energy that radiates through the whole universe. And in the process of traveling from the sun towards the earth, it passes through these various spheres of influence. Now, another theory is that the soul doesn't travel from our sun, but our soul actually travels from one solar system to another. So we're not just trapped in this solar system. And so if our soul has traveled at a certain point from another solar system into this one, we have to travel through the spheres. And the spheres are a symbolic representation of the various orbital patterns of our planet. So all the way from the outer reaches, you know, the plutonic belt of a plutoid comet sort of things. You have Uranus and Neptune, you have Saturn and Jupiter, you have, and then you have at the inner sphere, you have basically the sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. And so it passes through these various spheres of influence, each of which the orbital pattern is defining this sort of mathematical frequency, this resonant field that's affecting our soul vibration as we travel through here. So we come into human existence with a previous soul imprint of our planets. And so that's one of the core understandings when we're entering into the understanding of cosmic music and of classical music, of the ancient music, that will help us to clarify where the sounds that we're hearing today on the radio and on TV, where all that stuff comes from, the roots of this belief that there's a spiritual travel that happens for the soul when we reach this planet, and eventually that our soul is going to be liberated again.
A pragmatic way to look at it, Vinny, if you're a beginner to cosmology and the link between music and cosmology, are things like orbital patterns. Mercury has an 88-day orbital pattern around the sun, and there are 88 keys on the piano. So there are things that are very specific that we actually can directly correlate music to the spheres in the heavens. And it's not a coincidence, because the people that are creating the 12-tone systems and are creating the Western tonality system, we're doing it so for the church, and we're greatly inspired by the heavens, if not only inspired by the heavens, to create their systems of management for language and music.
Right. Also, Mercury, the planet Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun, has been sometimes seen as the moon of the sun, or the reflective surface that mirrors back the cosmic energies emitting from the sun. And a cool thing, if you look at the Hermetic alchemical tradition, Hermes, who's the god of knowledge, of music, of communication, Hermes is equated to the planet Mercury. Mercury and Hermes in thought, these were all the names of the same esoteric organism, which was corresponding to this planet. And that 88-day cycle, which corresponds to the 88-tone keyboard, interestingly enough, also corresponds to the idea that we write music down on a staff. Sheet music or a staff music, we put these tones or these notes, we project onto the staff. So it just brings me back to what you spoke about earlier, that you just tap with a magical wand or the magical staff on this pyramidal block and it'll levitate. Well, what about the idea that what you're tapping, that staff, is not with literally a rod, but it's with the rod of music. It's with the musical hermetic staff.
Or if it's an advanced piece of technology that actually manipulates the frequencies upon contact and infects whatever it is with that levitation, you know. And I would like to see this in my lifetime, actually, you know, come back into the use, because there's too much evidence to ignore that previous civilizations that through massive cataclysm in the Earth's history were completely wiped out and we lost all their technology. And archaeologists have been screaming about this for years, and they get called crazy conspiracy theorists and insane believers or whatever, when they've got real physical evidence of the existence of more advanced technology that the ancients possessed and used on a daily basis that is way better than whatever we've got today. You know, we've got Skype. Hey, they can lift 200-ton stones, bro.
If you look at the etymology of where we're coming from, the sort of pop culture research that we do stem from something called synchromysticism, which is finding like these meaningful nuggets of syntax in very mundane or ordinary media, everyday life, the most simple situations imaginable. If you can take that and see how many different narratives could be formed from the simplest of equations. And we take things, even biblical things, we could relate to music. If we do it in a free associative jazz-like style, we've looked at Moses and how he parts the Red Sea, and how we talked about cymatics and how music affects water as a variable, as the biggest medium. So Moses parting the Red Sea could also be Middle Sea. He's making a part between the waters. So I guess what I'm saying is that the syntax, as relevant as it might be to the individual, can also be very meaningful if thousands of people can agree upon it.
All right. Well, guys, we've come to the end of the show. I hope this has been enjoyable. In fact, I know that this has been enjoyable for you. I'm glad that I've been able to give you some levity and a little bit of fun, a little bit of coverage. And I want people to go to these websites if it's your forte, okay? For some people, a man in a pharaoh's headdress is a little bit much. But you can go to tonecoloralchemy.com. And check out a little bit more of the stuff, as well as indiegogo.com/projects/music-myth-cosmos. Guys, thank you very much. And we'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.